Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
All right, good to be with you, Payne and Pendergast, on a Wednesday. CJ Stroud was on Pat McAfee yesterday. McAfee has been one of the bigger advocates for NRG Stadium as an environment on game day. Now, keep in mind, much of McAfee's career coincided with a caliber of Texans football that lent itself to rabid crowds. You know,
right, McAfee, right,
he was there for the, you know, he overlapped during the really good Kubiak years, the early O'Brien years where they were making the postseason and the Colts had Andrew Luck, so the games had a lot of juice. But McAfee remembers an NRG Stadium that is coming back to that way now because the team is very good and likable and there's a bright future and whatnot. But he brought up with C.J. Stroud yesterday how the crowd's been at NRG Stadium this year.
How's the crowd's been? Crowd's been insane?
Yeah, it's been cool. Last game was like a playoff game. It was pretty nice. And, you know, it's 12 o'clock game is a little different in Houston just because, you know, there's a lot to do out here. So we really don't get nobody until like first quarter. But the people who come early, thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah. But it's all love, though. Like, it's been loud, though. It's been really loud. Like, the Bears game was amazing. Felt like a playoff game. Last game felt like a playoff game. So, you know, it's up on the uprise.
Yeah, there's a lot to do down there in Houston. That's why what you're able to do as a rookie down there without being distracted is insane.
The way you didn't go out at night, it's unbelievable.
It is, the one thing about, so I got to watch most of the third quarter down in the, with my family in the stands, and then I went back up to the press box during the game. Press box, it's hard to tell and judge sometimes just how loud it was. For whatever it's worth, when I was down there in the third quarter, I was impressed. I thought it was loud as hell. And that was without a lot of action at our end of the field, at least in the time that I was down there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, I was cool with it. I think the 12 o'clock start, I got to look around there. I've never paid attention to the Central Time Zone teams and if they're typically later arriving or not. Is this common in any team that has a Central Time Zone that it's a little bit later arriving?
Boy, that's a good question.
Or is that just a Houston thing?
That's a good question. Now, I've been to two Central Time Zone stadiums on the bye week over the last couple of years. Amy and I went to Green Bay for a game 2 years ago during the bye week, or 3 years ago, and then we went to Kansas City 2 years ago. I think those were late window games, though. I think those, because it was Green Bay and Seattle back when those two teams meant something, and it was Kansas City and Buffalo. I think those were like 3:25 games. Those places were filled a half hour before the game. Like, it's, again, 3:25. I know you're bringing up noon games. So it's a good question. Like, is this the norm?
I just don't think, I don't think it's, I think it is, I mean, because this is how Houston is. I mean, with the Astros, even still, baseball is different to begin with. But I think the Astros has become an earlier and earlier arriving crowd than, you know, certainly in the first couple years of this stretch. But, I was talking to my brother-in-law, who my nephew, the one that Bill O'Brien gave diabetes. My nephew Ryan has been a Texans fan in Bill's country since he was a toddler,
right.
So he's fought the good fight, being a fan of an expansion team in Bill's territory. And my brother-in-law is a Bills fan, but he does well, so I don't hold it against
he's
him.
He's okay.
But he even said, like, and he's a hardcore fan. He's got season tickets and everything. He's like, yeah, it's 12 o'clock. It's weird. I wouldn't have expected it, but it's kind of tough to really get going and get in.
It is a big hour, the difference between 12 and 1, I suppose. You know my feelings on this. Like, I this is not me telling people how to fan. If you're somebody who goes in midway through the first quarter, then you do you, man. I'm not going to tell you how to do it. I think it would benefit the Texans to have the crowd in there earlier. I think clearly the players, at least C.J. Stroud and others who've commented on it, vibe off of that. They come from colleges. A lot of these guys, Nick Caserio ain't drafting anybody from Slippery Rock State. Like, he's drafting guys from Georgia and LSU and Ohio State and Alabama. These are all guys that are used to people being in their seats, drunk as hell, at 11 in the morning if they have to be, you know?
And
it's a big change, I think. I think that's probably an adjustment for them. CJ seems to have come around on it a little bit. He seemed a little more flabbergasted by it last year, I think. Whereas this year, I think he's kind of settled in with, okay, the crowds are, like, for 90% of the game, they're in there and they're loud and they back us up and it's what it needs to be. I myself just don't understand spending hundreds of dollars on tickets and missing...
And missing the kickoff.
Missing 30% of the game, you know?
The part that I do understand is that we do that pregame show out there, and I smell the barbecue. I smell so much good food that I can't eat. It's really hard. It's the hardest challenge I face. Dylan Horton came back from cancer last week. Yeah. I would submit that his challenge is not as great as the one I have in smelling that delicious food and not being able to
His was bigger, but yours is,
whatever, Sean.
Next
you don't
on
know
the list.
You don't know my struggle.
Yes, I do. I know it as well as anybody. I sit next to you in the press box.
The other thing too, though. Okay, now this. Look, I don't know if it's a Houston culture thing or not. I don't know if we'll ever get it packed at the beginning of a game. There cannot be a Houston Texans chant going on as the offense is coming up to the line.
No.
Whoever started it, we need to nip it in the bud. We need to find out whoever starts the chant.
Yep.
I'll excuse everybody else that maybe follows along without thinking about it. But whoever starts that chant as the offense is taking the field, I'm sorry, you need to be banned for life.
Yes.
You're an insidious presence.
You're a wave starter. You're basically the guy starting the wave in the eighth inning of a close Astros game.
At least the wave isn't disruptive to the guys on the field. When you've got communication issues on offense because of the Houston Texans chant.
If I was a hitter, the wave would distract the hell out of me, but I'm easily distracted, so.
out of your peripheral, you see the wave.
Here it comes.
Ooh, this one's got good action.
Here it comes. All right, so how do we rate CJ's plea? To not even really a plea, but like sort of a kind of a subtle, like, hey, it'd be nice if you were in your seats.
I think he's doing the right thing.
Yeah,
he's not going full Caleb Williams, you know, telling the veterans to clean up their crap.
No, he's
not tone deaf, you know. He understands that he's asking something, and he doesn't want to come off like he's whining about the fans or anything, but he's just going to keep putting it out there.
I like how he couched it as, well, there's a lot to do in Houston. Like, no, well, there is a lot to do in Houston, but that's not the difference between showing up at kickoff and showing up midway through the first quarter.
Let me tell you, at Kirby and Merworth in Houston, there's not nearly as much to do as there is inside NRG.
Why are you late? It turns out 90% of the people who show up late were at NASA that morning taking a tour.
I didn't realize there was a Shipley at Merworth in Maine. I mean, like, I was almost there. I was going to get in, but my God.
Turns out there's a lot to do. There's a lot to do at Shipley's, So that was kind of funny. Back to football. Here was C.J. Stroud. So you've talked about this, Seth. You talked about it earlier in the show. This is what CJ is going to see for the rest of his career schematically from defenses, is this cover two.
Yeah.
We are not going to let you take the top off of our defense. We're taking the top off of your offense. Here was CJ Stroud talking about, quote, figuring out all this cover two that they're seeing.
Mel Kiper Jr. actually went on television and said, we need to ban cover two because of what it's doing to NFL offenses. You just talked about learning it. What does that mean for you? What, just taking the easy one as opposed to always taking the shot or trying to dissect the defense a little bit more? What do you mean by that whenever you say trying to figure out cover two a little bit more?
I've been playing against it forever, but, you know, it's a defensive philosophy, in my opinion, like bend, don't break, and just make you snap it over and over and over and over, you know? So, I mean, that's where I think we can get better for the Texans, just, you know, being able to get our running game going a little more, also, you know, not taking any not just getting cheap penalties, because then that puts you in a backed up situation, or first and 20, second and 20, first and 15, second and 15. I mean, you're living on third down, and it's hard to live on third down in the NFL. So I would say, like, you know, I'm taking what's there, I'm taking the shots when I see them, but also, you know, just, you know, being able to stay in the positive, stay in the green is what we talk about here. And I think, you know, that's kind of what defenses are doing nowadays to, you know, some of the premier quarterbacks. You see Mahomes gets to a ton, Josh Allen gets to a ton. You know, it's hard to always just be patient. Sometimes you just want to force it down the field. So, you know, it's just a lot of maturity that you have to have at this position when you're, you know, looked at as one of the guys that can, you know, beat a defense and they want to take you away.
So it's happening around the league, but going into the last week, the Texans had faced more cover two than any other offense in the league. So it's happening to an extreme degree to C.J. Stroud with all those receivers that he has. Teams are just saying, "Yep, we're not going to mess around with this. We're going to force you to matriculate the ball down the field," old Stram used to say, right? And it's hard to do. And it's funny because you see the pendulum swing where years and years and years, running backs don't matter as much. The running game doesn't matter. The perfect antidote to cover two is to run the football. But now you got league teams around the league that actually have never really had to learn how to run the football or haven't focused on it as much as they should. So what should be easy, running the ball versus cover two, the teams aren't good. The Texans aren't good at it. And it's frustrating because it's supposed to be easy. Like, only really, really excellent defenses back in the day could defend the run out of cover two consistently. Yeah. It was just like, you're conceding the run. Now teams are like, oh, wait, we can play cover two and they can't run the ball? Yeah. Oh, this is awesome. Yeah. This is awesome.
Yeah. No, and thank God your quarterback's a superhero. No, you're right. There's teams that haven't had to do it, haven't focused on it. What's frustrating about the Texans is they are a team that's focused on it, and they still can't do it, you know?
Yeah.
They do focus on running the football a lot.
Right. And I see people say, well, use the pass to set up the run. No, they've already done it for you. Like, it's already – the game plan the defense is giving the Texans is – Please, we're inviting you to run. Feel free. So it should be easy pickings. That's what's frustrating about it.
How much does Joe Mixon help in that, you know, this weekend and in the future? Yeah, a lot.
Now, I think that the offensive line has made progress, and I think it's going to get better as the year goes on. But part of it is simply that Joe Mixon's he's a different level of human being in terms of just his skill set, his vision, all of that.
Stature.
Than any of these running backs on the roster
right now.
Yeah. So I don't know if it'll be Joe Mixon's best season on a per-game basis or anything like that, but it'll be a more competent rushing attack.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, like, is everything CJ was just talking about, they're just – the defense is waiting for you to make a mistake when they're playing a bunch of cover two. And the Texans have obliged. They've just shot themselves. So the defense is saying, you know what, you might get 10 plays, but it's really hard for you to go 10, 15 plays every single drive and score consistently. And so far it's worked out. The Texans are not scoring a lot of points.
No.
You know, CJ's putting in good passing performances, doing some really good stuff out there, but they haven't been able to translate it into actual points because they can't run the football.
Because
they commit too many self-inflicted wounds.
That's the biggest thing for me. The last thing you said there, and by self-inflicted wounds I hear penalties.
Mostly
when
the
you
penalties,
say that.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So that's the biggest thing to me is the penalties. When they were playing clean, they weren't running the ball great against Buffalo on Sunday. Right. But in the first half, they had no penalties in the first half. And they probably should have had 21 or 24 points in that half. They left some points on the board in that half. Two of the drives they had where they ended up making mistakes, the fourth and one, the fourth quarter drive where CJ threw the pick where it was 20-17 and now you're driving. And man, they were in range to at least get a field goal and force Buffalo to score a touchdown to win the game. If not, drive down and go get a touchdown to make it a two-score game, and you make mistakes. Those two drives that resulted in 0 points, both of them, were both over 5.5-minute, 6-minute drives that they had together. They were double-digit number of plays. They were doing what you're talking about, which is, hey, man, we're being forced to dink and dunk, be okay in the run game, keep it in good down and distance situations. So they're doing that. That's why I'm optimistic. Like, they're doing, if they just don't, if I had to eradicate one thing, I would say just, if I had a choice, Seth, between being an above average run team or eradicating the penalties, I would take the penalties out of it. Because I feel like if they can just be a run game that gets you in 2nd and 6 or 3rd and 4, that CJ's going to be just fine. The penalties are the things that put you in 2nd and 15, 2nd and 20, you know, stuff like that.
The other thing, too. And it's something, the one really encouraging thing about the Bills' victory was that it was still sloppier than they can get away with being week in and week out. The Texans were sloppier than they can get away with consistently. But I like that a couple of the self-inflicted wounds were turnovers and they still won the game.
Yes.
Because the Texans defense should be creating more turnovers than they are right now. They could have, you know, they had their chances in that game. Aziz Alshire had two very achievable chances for interceptions in that game. But CJ coughed the ball up twice, and that's not who he is. I think that's just a little bit of a fluke. Good play by the Bills on both of those. But they were still able to win the game. At least those are football mistakes, at least.
Yes.
Those are like classic things that happen in a football game as opposed to having 12 penalties.
Yeah, as opposed to dumb stuff. You know, like
I felt bad for Dalton Schultz and his unsportsmanlike because I did the exact same thing once in my
career.
Spun the
ball?
So Dalton, he just, you know, kind of spun the ball, but it went into the guy that was laying on the ground, and it's a bad look.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what he intended to do.
No.
One time we were playing the Dolphins. Dolphins, yeah. And we tackled Ricky Williams for a loss, and the ball popped out when he hit the ground, and it went right to me. And that year, one of the points of emphasis was like, hey, guys, leave the ball at the spot of the play so the officials don't have to go running for it, okay? We're not cleaning up after you anymore. So I got the ball. The ball was in my hand. It popped right into my hand.
Did you think it was a fumble?
No. Like, it whistled. I could see, like, Ricky Williams landed on his back. The ball popped out.
Up.
So
I
knew it wasn't a fumble.
Yep.
And, I mean, he was down by contact.
Yep.
But it popped right into my hands. And so I'm sitting there with it, and I look to the left, I look to the right, I was going to hand it to an official. And there was no official, so I started to stand up and just drop the ball, but Ricky was still laying there, and it dropped right on his chest. And to everybody in the stands, everywhere, like, everybody thought that I was being a D-bag to poor little Ricky Williams with his social anxiety disorder and everything. And Ricky actually thought I was doing it, too. He got up and got in my face. Ricky Williams.
Wow.
They actually got Ricky Williams angry.
Yeah, that's hard to do.
I felt bad. I was like, I genuinely felt bad because I felt like, oh, here's this, like, soft-spoken, gentle giant,
okay. And
he's mad at me, of all people.
You felt bad.
Even though I was trying to break his ribs, like, 3 seconds prior to that.
Of course you were. Yeah. That's your job.
Yeah.
But, okay, so you felt bad, but when he got up and got in your face, did you say, hey, man, I'm really sorry, I feel bad, or did you put on your football bravado face? Just inside, you're like, I feel bad about this, but I can't be a wuss about it. I got to come back at Ricky Williams.
Well, for one, first, I got flagged, by the way.
Okay.
I got flagged and unsportsmanlike. I got fined for it. I had to talk to the folks on Park Avenue on a conference call.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah.
I hate conference calls. Oh.
Yeah. Had to stand up to the man.
Yeah.
And, but no. In the moment, I was still trying to process, like, why is he so mad at me?
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized, I was like, and no, I said, I remember to this day, because it felt weird. I was like, Ricky, Ricky. I said it exactly like that. I was like, Ricky, 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 no, Ricky.
All I can think of.
It was a preseason game. That was why it was even worse.
Okay.
Because it was like, yeah, what am I?
Dude,
I'm not that guy, Ricky. I don't do stuff like that.
I was about to go box score fishing on profootballreference.com to go find it so I could see.
It was a preseason game.
Okay.
And then I felt awful because I got sent to the sideline because they were in a nickel and dime situation. And the Dolphins ended up having a really nice drive in a preseason game where I remember Robert Smith and Gary Walker had to go out for like 10 extra reps on a long, long drive because we had stopped them on third down and they would have punted if it weren't for my unsportsmanlike.
Oh my God. From what you said about Gary Walker, I'm sure he handled that just fine, having to go out there
for 10 plays because of you. He gets it. No.
You dropped the ball on Ricky Williams' chest. Oh, that's funny.
Things happen.
Yeah.
They knew there was an injustice.
Yep. Yep, that's funny. More McAfee with CJ. This is good. I mean, I think we here in Houston feel it, and I think more importantly, people around the league look at this pairing of D'Amico Ryans and CJ Stroud, and they're like, all right, these guys, this is going to be a problem for a long, long time. It's good to be on this side of it in Houston. Here was CJ Stroud yesterday with McAfee asking him, how's D'Amico been in year two as a head coach?
How's D'Amico this year, second-year head coach, as opposed to first? Now, obviously, you will say you don't know what other coaches are like around the NFL. You've only been in the NFL for 2 years because you say everything right all the time, which is why they need to trade you out of the AFC South, okay?
Nah.
But what have you seen from Coach D'Amico this year versus last year, and how do you think teams responding here in his second year as head coach?
Yeah, I think, you know, teams know how dangerous we can be, and, you know, they try to challenge us in many different ways, but I think D'Amico's done a good job of, you know, just keeping us motivated to, you know, understand that we have a target on our back, but at the same time, just accept it, embrace it, you know, fight fire with fire. So, you know, I definitely think that we've been able to do that. But honestly, we haven't been able to, you know, play our best ball yet. And that's kind of a good thing because we're sitting here 4-1, not played our best ball yet. And, you know, I think now every single game we're taking steps to that, play a 4-quarter game. So, you know, I definitely see, you know, just a lot of things going on the uprise for us.
Yeah, of course, 4-1, haven't played good football yet.
Yikes.
Houston Texans are supposed to suck forever, brother.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was what was supposed to happen.
Not anymore.
You know it. You know it. You know it.
Uh-huh.
You know it.
Damn right.
Everybody in the back knows it. And then this guy shows up with D'Amico, and it's all flipped on its head immediately overnight. And that's good for the city of Houston. Good football fans down here.
Feels a little disingenuous, Pat. I don't think you're that happy for us. Hey, just real quick.
I don't think Pat McAfee actually cares.
No, but he did it like... I listened to that interview. I was sitting in traffic on the 610 loop yesterday. There was a truck fire on the 610 loop. And if any of you were sitting in this in the middle of the afternoon, you know, like literally at a standstill for like an hour yesterday from like 2:30 till 3:45 or so, I was sitting on the 610 loop. And
where was the smoke going?
It was,
wasn't going towards you.
I couldn't even see. I was so, dude, I was so far back. I only saw the only saw the smoldering remains of the truck once I got up there. But you tell me if I'm off base here, because I feel like you and I have similar sensibilities on this. I was listening to this CJ McAfee interview yesterday while I was sitting in traffic, and I was so angry sitting in traffic, so angry, because I'm never out and about during the day. You know, I'm not used to this. McAfee's whole, oh, this sucks that the Texans are good, and the all the little jokes about how frustrated he is and trade him out of the. They were making me. I'm like, okay, I'm done with these jokes. Like, we've reached the end point here for the I'm the frustrated Colts guy. Whenever I have a Texans guy on, is that frustration from sitting in traffic, or is that getting to be a tired bit? You tell me.
I don't know. You know what? It feels like I wish you would just turn it into outright animosity. It's hard. It feels. I don't know. It feels like he's sucking up to him, and it almost feels disingenuous.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Part of it is also, I think, that because he's in wrestling, because he's a WWE commentator, that you almost, it's impossible to like be like, all right, is this a, how much of this is a work versus is he like, does he actually feel this way?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
I don't trust that they're genuine emotions just because of his wrestling background.
I think it was my frustration in the moment in traffic. I'm listening to it again. I'm like, all right, I probably got a little overly agitated yesterday. He does it all the time, though. Anytime there's a Texans guy on, it's like, oh, you're supposed to be back.
Does he still do it with CJ? It's more just kind of smack talk, right? Well, his buddies there, his minions will talk more
the
smack
minions.
To JJ. Did I say CJ? With JJ, I mean.
Yeah. Oh, with JJ Watt. Yeah.
Yeah, with JJ Watt.
D'Amico and CJ. This is nice, man. These two fellas here getting along as well as they do. But they're hungry at 4-1. You know, 4-1, and they're not feeling great about how they've looked being 4-1 right now.
Right. Yeah. No, and that's where what was that? Is that the audio you're playing?
No. We just played it. The McAfee.
Okay.
It's CJ talking about D'Amico in year two. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. He finished that one talking about how hungry they were. Yeah. Right. No, that's sorry, you got me sidetracked with the McAfee stuff.
I'm sorry about that.
No, as far as what CJ said in that clip at the end of it, is that, there's no part of me that feels like the Texans players themselves feel like they've arrived. I feel like I think there's an appropriate level of frustration where you don't want it to turn into pressing too hard, but I do think that every quote, everything that any of the players say after these games is basically, we got to be better than this. You know, and meanwhile, they're 4-1. It could be very, very easy to slip into that kind of thought that, we just know how to win. Team of destiny, whatever it might be. I think they're very aware of the fact that they need to be better than this, and I like that part of it. I'm not as nervous as I might otherwise be, where it feels like it's a little bit of a Fugazi 4-1. Like, okay, those guys feel the same way.
Yeah, I feel good about this team right now. Like, I know that there is a better version of them in there somewhere. You know, like, it's some of the stuff that's kept the score so close in these games is so fixable, you know? So I feel really good about them. A lot of people weighing in on getting into the game in time for kickoff. Someone says security sucks getting into the game. It takes forever. We only walk past the entry on the south end of the stadium. You and I walk past it every game to go after the pregame's over to go into the stadium. I did think that. I'm like, man, those are some long lines right there. There could be some people. I hate waiting in lines. I hate sitting in traffic, as I just outlined. Like, if I know there's traffic, I'd rather go in. If I have to be somewhere, I'd rather wait like an extra hour to not have to sit in traffic as opposed to getting out there and being somewhere early. So I kind of understand that. It's just, to me, it's like what you're spending on tickets. Like, I'm there for the game. But I get it. It's the lines are long sometimes.
It was long going in. When we walked through the West Club, when we walked into the game from our pregame show, it was really lined up at the southeast entrance there. Like, I don't remember it being lined up that deep. So I think I think more people are trying to get in earlier. It bottlenecks.
Takes a while. Yeah. Text message.
Don't be the guy arguing with the security checkpoint, the security guard about your jackknife. That happened to me at Minute Maid once. I was standing in line, and a guy didn't realize he had his jackknife with him, and he was like, I don't know. It was a few people ahead of me. I have no idea what he could have been arguing with them about. Like, dude, they're not going to let you bring the jackknife in.
No.
Like, I don't know. What are you? How are you trying to talk your way into bringing the jackknife in? I don't know if it was his grandpappy's jackknife or something. He didn't want to lose it, but like it was. Oh. It ended up being. So don't be that guy. Okay. Just remember to leave. Remember to leave all your sharp objects in your car, and don't be a brat about it. If all of a sudden they're not going to let you take the jackknife.
How sentimental or expensive would an item have to be for you to go all the way back out to your car to put it in your car and then get in line again?
I know. I don't know. Or expensive. It could be a really nice, I don't know. That could have been a pearl handled, whatever. It's tough.
$100.
You got to bite the bullet and go walk back to your car and put it in there. Yeah.
$100. If it's under $100, then I'm just handing it over. If it's replaceable, if it has no sentimental value.
I think I might just be giving the security guard like $20 or something. Be like, hey, can you hold on to this?
I like it.
Find you after the game.
Best solution is bribery. I dig that. I like that.
Of course, that might get the security guard fired.
Definitely would get him fired. What do you mean? Of course it would.
It turns out it's a murder weapon or
$20
something.
So I can bring my knife into the security?
No, not to bring it in. To hold it for him until the end of the game.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. You come back and get it. I see. Does Houston have?
I wouldn't. If I were gonna bribe the guy to bring a weapon in, I wouldn't start with 20. Well, maybe I would. You never know.
It might be really stupid. Yeah. This is a text message. Is Houston having one of the best tailgating atmospheres have anything to do with it? Yes.
Yeah, 100%.
That's a lot to do with it.
You guys got to start cutting off the booze to all these freeloaders that are coming by your tents and an hour before the game.
Yep,
I don't know.
Yep. Payne and Pendergast with you. We'll get to more of CJ Stroud on McAfee a little later in the show. Did you see that Deshaun Watson resolved that latest lawsuit? We didn't hit that yesterday. The lawsuit, the most recent one that was the most graphic out of all of them, didn't involve a massage therapist. That kind of got resolved sort of under the radar. It wasn't a big news item yesterday. He resolved his lawsuit, the latest lawsuit, which alleged that a girl he was on a date with or at her apartment, some really bad stuff allegedly
went on.
This
one had alleged forcible rape, which is a different level of transgression.
Yeah. So it was different than the massage lawsuits. I thought about Browns fans immediately, and I haven't checked to see if this is the case, but there were probably Browns fans rooting that he was going to get a key, like that he wasn't going to
settle.
Somehow
it would get him suspended.
It would
right.
go to court, and all kinds of stuff would come out, because the NFL said they were now. The NFL said they were investigating it, so maybe they're still investigating it, and there could be a suspension coming down the line. But the settlement, if I had to guess, the settlement would preclude the alleged victim from speaking with the NFL, from cooperating with the NFL.
Yeah.
And if she doesn't cooperate with the NFL, then you're kind of screwed. Because
then they don't have that much to go on. And
the
previous 11-game suspension was done without Deshaun have been found criminally.
No criminal stuff.
Yeah. And the lawsuits, not all the lawsuits have been settled, but still.
Yeah. So Browns fans, you're still on the hook for the 172 million of dead cap money if you get rid of Deshaun.
The stat that was floating around yesterday is that he now has more lawsuits resolved than he has touchdowns with the Browns.
23-19.
What's going to happen? Okay, what do you think happens to Deshaun after he leaves Cleveland? Do you think he plays football again?
Nope.
Or do you think he's just done?
Well, I'm assuming that we're assuming that this is the version of Deshaun football-wise that it's going to be the rest
of
his
time.
Yeah,
that's where I don't know if he's just even, if his heart is in it anymore.
Right.
Like, does he even want it? If you had to guess, once Cleveland cuts ties with him, do you think he plays football again?
I don't, because I don't think he has it in him to be a backup. I don't think that suits his ego. He's got plenty of money. I don't know how much he loves football.
Yeah.
I don't know if a team wants to. Deshaun has turned himself into one of the most toxic Is cancer an overstatement to say, like, in the building there?
Okay, the Browns made that. They made that deal with the devil where they said, all right, a lot of people are going to hate this. A lot of our own fans are going to hate this. But the upside is, man, people forget a lot of stuff when you win a bunch of football games.
Yeah.
And that obviously hasn't worked out. Yeah, so other teams are going to look at it and probably think, no, this isn't worth whatever we get from our fan base or whatever. You know, there's no, the trade-off isn't there.
Yeah.
So I'll be, now, I never say never because just so many things happen. Guys get third, fourth opportunities.
Yep.
But with Deshaun, I guess the part that I can't figure out is he might hate the situation he's in. He's not happy, you know, and he feels like he hasn't been treated fairly, whatever. It's not like he's gone into a cocoon. He's still out there on Instagram showing off his brand new cars and everything.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he's as self-aware of exactly how reviled he is. I don't know if he, even though he doesn't like the criticism and the questions and all that, I don't know. I think maybe he's in enough of a bubble that he feels like, oh yeah, other teams will see that I'm just in a bad situation and I'll go off and Bill O'Brien will get hired somewhere else and I'll go with him.
It's a great question. It really is. I think he's done. I don't know how many teams even want him. I don't know how much he wants to play. I think you combine the fact with I'm not sure how much he likes football with I'm not sure what teams would even touch him. I think when you combine those two things, the favorite is he doesn't play. Again, I got a crazy Deshaun stat for you that's an actual football stat. This was in The Athletic yesterday. Deshaun has had one game, and this stat, just to back up, kind of illustrates what the Browns thought they were getting in Deshaun. They thought they were getting the Deshaun that led the league in passing yardage in 2020 on an awful football team.
Mm-hmm.
Deshaun has had one game as a Brown with 250 yards passing and two touchdown passes. One game where he's had both those stats. In 2020 in Houston, he did that 11 times in that season alone.
God.
On a bad Texans team. On a team that went 4-12. On a team that went 4-12. Now, one of the reasons he probably could pass for a lot of yards on a bad football team is you're behind and you're throwing and, you know, there's a lot of garbage yards in there and things like that. But still, he's done it once in his three partial seasons with the Browns so far. He did it 11 times his last season with the Texans, 250 and two touchdowns.
If you take just the money that Deshaun will make in Cleveland, because it's all guaranteed,
yeah,
it'd be about $138 million after taxes. Actually, I don't know what the state income tax, if there's state income tax or what it is in Cleveland. So let's call it even $120 million. Okay. Even if he had spent super, super aggressively, it's hard for me to believe that he's going to spend $20 million of that. But let's say that he did. Let's say he ends up with $100 million in the bank. And super conservatively, he can live off of $3 million a year for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
With zero risk, really, whatsoever. And he also doesn't look like he enjoys playing football anymore.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think he's playing football again.
Yeah, that's, yeah, I think that's the favorite. That's a great question. I think that's the favorite.
Could you live off of... put that Pender poll up. Could you guys live comfortably off of $3 million per year for the rest of your life?
I would love for that one to be split. It's 52-48. No. That would be really funny. We're getting some people texting in like, hey, guys, Rockets Thunder tonight. Preseason. I haven't gotten into preseason basketball yet, but Reed Sheppard was named. They did the GM poll for all the awards. Reed Sheppard, in a landslide, won the GM's named Reed Sheppard Rookie of the Year. 50%, he got half the votes. Rockets may have stumbled into this, man. Like,
I gotta get it. Yeah, okay, all right, good. I'm glad that people are pointing out. I gotta carve out some time tonight, and I'm gonna get amped up about the Rockets. Could come in tomorrow, and I'm gonna have a pep talk for everybody to get geared up
for the Rockets. You are okay. Good.
Yes,
I'm here for that.
Rockets preseason basketball.
I'm here for that. Yeah. 43% said Reed Sheppard will be the best player out of this class in 5 years. So, like, for all this drafting of all these guys, two first-round picks every year the last few years, the guy who may end up being the linchpin in this whole thing was almost viewed like a gravy pick. You know what I mean? You weren't expecting... That was Brooklyn's pick. It was forecasted to be 10th or whatever. It gets bumped up in the lottery to third, and now, bam, you're landing on a kid that there's, you know, this is as close as the consensus GMs have had on somebody other than Victor Wembanyama, it feels like, the last few years.
Are the Rockets leaning into the Cocaine Curry nickname?
Not that I've noticed. Not that I've noticed.
I don't know, man. If they want an edge, you know where they got to do that? They got to do that on their TikTok account.
Yeah.
This is where the TikTok is where all these pro sports teams let their freak flag fly. Everything else is kind of like, all right, a little bit edgy and everything. TikTok, it's all over the place. So lean into Cocaine Curry.
Cocaine Curry's okay, but remember the nickname one of our listeners came up with for him? Cracker McBuckets.
That's pretty good too.
That's better.
They should lean into that one.
Cracker McBuckets. Yes. Yeah. So that was cool. Hey, one quick cut here. This is pretty funny. As long as we're talking about the Rockets, we didn't get to this yesterday. I had this pedicasted yesterday, but Steven Adams is a Rocket now. We get to experience that. Steven Adams, the gigantic 7-footer for years with the Thunder and the Pelicans and whatnot. He is a Houston Rocket. Now, Alperen Şengün is the starting center, so Adams is going to be coming off the bench. Jonathan Fagan, who covers the Rockets, asked this question of Steven Adams.
This created a big, this is weird. This got controversial. Yeah.
Yes. Here was Jonathan Fagan asking Steven Adams about, do you still see yourself as a starter?
Think of yourself still as a starter who doesn't start, or you have to have a different mindset?
What?
Do you think of yourself still as a starter?
Because... Well, no, I'm not starting.
Okay.
Yeah, so, right, I'm a basketball player. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no, like, starter and bench. It's just whoever you think is best, that's what you play.
Okay.
I feel like that answer.
I like the answer. I felt bad for Jonathan Fagan because I understood what he was asking and where he was going with it. People interpreted it like Fagan was trying to create controversy between Adams and Şengün, or that somehow kind of craft some kind of narrative. But because Adams didn't really understand, I don't think Adams understood exactly where Fagan was going with it. And also, he's going to be super cognizant of, like, I don't want to look like I'm the guy that. It's hard for him to answer that question.
I'm angling for Alperen's minutes.
Yeah. Like, it's going to be interpreted. Like, Adams knows that the headline would be, you know, Steven Adams thinks that Şengün's spot is his or something like that.
Yeah.
So I understand the question, and I understand Adams' response to it. I was kind of surprised by how many people were just torching Fagan for asking, they are calling it the dumbest question they'd ever heard.
Dude,
not to mention you get all of New Zealand up in arms over it, like all 27,000 of them or whatever. So poor Fagan's getting raked through the coals, and I'm sure he doesn't care one bit about it.
This is the trash Steven Adams. I did too. This is the trash Steven Adams has to deal with.
Yeah.
That was funny. All right, Peyton Pendergast with you. Hey, let's circle over the Astros for a minute. Yet another Alex Bregman teammate gives what I interpret as a ringing endorsement to bring Alex Bregman back to the Houston Astros. We'll have that for you coming up next.
Sports Radio 610 presents Payne and Pendergast.
Taylor Scott, of all people, got me nervous about losing Alex Bregman. Taylor Scott, middle reliever, had a nice season for the Astros from South Africa. He was the last guy to make the team out of spring training. Ended up having a really solid season for the Astros. He was great in the first half of the season. He did an interview. He made me more nervous about losing Alex Bregman when he was asked about Bregman. I'll find what podcast this was on while we're playing the audio here. But Alex Bregman and the help that he provides to the pitching staff. We knew about it already, but here's yet another example from Taylor Scott.
Tell me a little bit about what you get from these elite hitters on the Astros and what they can share with you. I know Bregman's been involved in some of the pitching discussions.
Yeah, no, he was. He literally took it pretty seriously. Throughout the year, we were talking about how to read hitter swings and, you know, how they take certain pitches kind of tells you what they're looking for. And that's the side of the game I never kind of understood or looked at. And so we would always ask him about that. And yeah, he's so smart, and he's just the pure baseball guy. And so he started doing his own scouting reports on hitters and telling us, you know, this guy can't hit this pitch. He crushes this kind of pitch. Stay away from this and that. And it was a game changer because it actually, like, sometimes the scan reports didn't tell you what he was telling you, and he was spot on just because he knows the game and knows these hitters and how they swing.
Did he ever help you or help others on the staff with things like pitch tipping?
Yes. He would do that all the time. Or if you could go to him and say, hey, can you see if I was tipping today? And he would go sit down and look at all your pitches and let you know what he sees.
In the front office of the Astros got to be like, Taylor, shut up. When we don't pay him, you're just making people angrier.
That's I know. The fact that Alex Bregman is a force multiplier in a sport that, you know, it's of all the team sports, it's the one that feels most like it's nine guys playing an individual sport, which is an exaggeration, obviously. But the fact that you can have a player like that seems to be available and a good resource to so many different guys, kind of in the same way, like, you know, aside from the garbage can stuff, Carlos Beltran was really valuable in that regard as well. The conventional pitch tipping stuff and all of that, Carlos Beltran was a genius at that, and that has a trickle down effect on everybody else in the clubhouse. I wonder what the analytics bros do with that, if they've got kind of splits versus, you know, guys that have like, what's the Alex Bregman effect?
Well,
can you figure out how much having a guy that's a resource like that actually does help the rest of the guys?
Yeah, how do you quantify it? Because it sounds to me like it's a big deal. He's not the only pitcher talking about that. I mean, Hunter Brown is probably the most famous example of Bregman helping a guy out and turning, I mean, if we're talking about Hunter Brown, we're talking about turning his career around, possibly, at least early on here. That part concerns, you know what concerns me about it? And by the way, that audio is from the podcast. Rob Friedman is the name of, he's at Pitching Ninja. He's a good Twitter follow. He posts videos of a lot of like super nasty pitches that guys have, if you're into that kind of thing. The thing that makes me nervous, two things about the Bregman stuff. One, listening to Taylor Scott talk about that, like, God forbid he signs with a team that's in the way of the Astros getting back to a World Series at some point, because it sounds like Bregman knows a lot about a lot of hitters. He knows a real lot about a lot of hitters on the Astros. Like, he'd basically be handing over the answers to the test to whoever the pitching staff is of his new team. The second thing that worries me, Michael Schwab posted the list of the free agent third baseman in this marketplace coming up here in November, sorted by WAR, wins above replacement. Alex Bregman easily number one at 4.1 wins above replacement. That's a really solid number. Next closest one, Paul DeJong of the Kansas City Royals at 1.7. There's a massive drop off. There's barely any there's barely any third baseman free agents on the market that have above a one win above replacement.
This is what I would say about Alex Bregman and his cumulative WAR since 2017 and all of that. Look, yeah, we get it, and I know there's a lot of pressure on Crane to break your rule and go more than 5 years on the extension, all of that. But like let's call it what it is. It's not a smooth ride with Bregman. It comes in waves, and then those waves leave and you're in a vast, desolate and barren desert for a while. And it's not like it's always like, oh wow, yeah, you can always rely on Alex Bregman. No, you can rely on Alex Bregman when he's in one of his good stretches. So let's, the hometown discount is rarely ever valid, but Altuve has done it a couple times. You know, Altuve has re-upped before free agency. Altuve flat out wanted to be here. We've suffered through some droughts with you, Alex Bregman. We've stood by your side for the most part through your many, 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 many slow beginnings to seasons. So maybe bend a little bit, okay?
Okay.
You don't have to be Joe Hardcore. I'm doing this to set a good precedent, free agency guy. Do the right thing here. Take a little bit of a hometown discount.
Okay, because you're imploring him to take a hometown discount. You brought up you brought up his streakiness.
Yes.
We need to save this audio for next season when, Donovan Solano is the starting third baseman for the Houston. When Abraham Toro, who's fifth among free agent third basemen in wins above replacement, is the starting third baseman Astros
next
year.
I will blame Alex Bregman's avarice. Brazen greed, wanton materialism. Oh God!
When Whit Merrifield, I miss you.
I'll give you anything, Alex. Sorry, I take it all back.
I'm sorry, I hate Whit Merrifield. I love you, and Alex.
I should have given you everything. Sorry. Here, take my watch.
Sorry, I'm a Yankee for the next 8 years. Okay, and here's the answers to what every Astro hitter likes over the plate.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, boy. Yeah, that man. Part of it. Don't go within the division. Don't go in the
division. Get out of the American League. Go to the National League.
Yeah, preferably, but by all means, stay the hell out of the division.
Yeah, 13 please. Games of Alex Bregman giving the answers to the test to all of his teammates. All the
so
whole
what we need
staff.
Is the Las Vegas A's, a resurgent Las Vegas A's with Alex Bregman as the team leader.
I'm not worried about him. He won't be in the division. None of those teams are Angels, yeah. Mariners, A's, Rangers. None of them are. Those aren't Alex Bregman. I'm worried about. I'm worried about the Yankees. I'm worried about the Red Sox. You know, if some team is, you know, some team that's on the cusp is looking to get to make a big splash, I'm worried about that. But
do you think that? Yeah.
What were you gonna say?
No.
Yeah. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Boy, people feel a certain kind of way about getting into the stadium early. We're getting a lot of texts from people. Someone's suggesting that they open the gates to the parking lots at 7 o'clock instead of 8 o'clock, so then people can get in their 4 hours of tailgating.
Yeah,
by 11, you know, they can get their tailgating in. Okay, and they'll maybe, you know, as opposed to like getting 4 hours of tailgating in, butting up right against the kickoff. You know,
they should open the roof up and airlift people in more quickly. You could have like a satellite. Do they have those Uber air taxis yet? Are those things are they a thing yet?
Not yet.
Okay, I don't keep up with the news. Yeah. I just assumed we'd have them by now.
No,
okay.
Or hot air balloon rides into the stadium and drop down in there. That would be fun.
Come on, think outside the box, Cal.
Literally land a blimp in the middle of the field with the roof open. That would be crazy.
It sounds like it might be as simple as just having more security checkpoints or just changing the security.
Yeah, I don't know what you do about that though. I mean, the stadium's the stadium, you know. It's
But maybe you can start this. I don't know. Like when they had the Super Bowl there, it was like five different security layers you had to go through.
Yeah,
I don't know. Just have a satellite. Just move the ring out a little further to where you go through security.
Maybe. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you on a Wednesday.
DeMeco, get rid of security altogether, but just become more punitive. Basically, enact you get caught trying to bring something in, you're going to get your hand cut off.
Vigilante justice. Yes.
Like the punishment will be so severe that you can actually be a little less vigilant on the enforcement of it. Yes.
Very creative. Good idea. DeMeco Ryan's coaches show talked about the swarm. Nick Caserio had some interesting stuff to say, too, about how they slowed the Buffalo Bills down. How are we feeling about this Texans defense as we move into into week six and the second third of the season here? We will talk about that, and we'll hear from DeMeco Ryans coming up next.